Before we get going on this episode, we wanted to let you know about a new hybrid health check tool that Audium has just launched. It's for any organisation to check the pulse of their current approach to hybrid work, or any work style for that matter. And our AI-powered analytics engine uses your employees' comments to help you understand what's helping and hindering your people wherever they're working. And because Audium takes a holistic perspective, you can get fast, evidence-based, actionable insights about their spaces, their technology, and the business impacts of their day-to-day employee workplace experience. Now, Ian, can you give us a little example of how this can help organisations?
So let me quickly tell you about a global non-profit called World Animal Protection. They're an animal welfare charity with people working all over the world. And during the pandemic, they pivoted to a choice-based version of hybrid called Work Appropriately, which means that they've got different teams working together in different ways, pretty much in every time zone. Now, they've been using Audium to both monitor the workplace experience of their global workforce and also to inform their future workplace strategy. They've collected data using Audium, like the new hybrid health check, and they've also run existing employee engagement data that they already had collected through Audium's AI to find more actionable workplace insights.
So there you go, folks. Whatever your flavour of hybrid or blend of work styles, you can unlock your workplace potential with Audium. To find out more about the hybrid health check, visit audium.io/hybrid. Hello and welcome to Workplace Geeks, the podcast that guides you through the unexplored wilderness of professional workplace insights. I'm Chris Moriarty.
And I'm Ian Ellison.
Now, picture us as your trusty mapmakers leading the expedition to unearth buried gems of workplace wisdom. So gear up, fellow explorers, as we blaze trails, uncover riches, and unveil the secrets hidden within the intricate tapestry of modern workplace. Now, I told you we'd be back in 7 days. Thanks to everyone who's engaged with last week's episodes. It's always a little nervy releasing a new episode after such a break. But here we are, we're back. And we're firing on all cylinders. Now, we won't be bringing the mailbag back until the first episode of our third series. So let's dive straight into today's episode. Ian, what do we have in store?
Okay, Chris, so today we've got part two of our WorkTech 23 double header. Now, if part one from last time was about sustainable cities and buildings, part two is essentially three takes on workplace change.
Sounds interesting. So who have we got up first?
First up, we've got Dr. Valeria Winkworth. She's a director at EY in the People Advisory Services area. And Valeria was there at WorkTech to essentially share insights from a new piece of EY research that she was involved with, conducted in collaboration with Oxford University's Said Business School. Now, her session was called Transforming with Humans at the Centre. And so obviously, it's all about organisational transformation, in other words, change, and how success lies in understanding and addressing human emotions. So it's based on quite an extensive piece of work, insights from nearly 1,000 senior leaders, direct reports, over 1,000 workforce members across 23 countries and 16 industries. Pause, deep breath. And it all rolls up to reveal six pivotal drivers of human behaviour that can more than double the likelihood of successful transformation when understood and addressed effectively.
So let's see what Valeria had to say.
So who am I? First of all, I'm a mum of two young children, and that's really my most important trait. But on my day job, I'm actually a director at EY People Advisory Services. So I do live in the world of people consulting, organizational change, in all things humans at the centre, which is really why I'm here today. I'm here to talk about our research around the humans at the centres of any transformation and how that can really trigger success within a transformation, and kind of a bit of a translation of what does that mean when we then look at the tech horizon, which again is another piece of research that EY has launched, and how do we translate it all together into a real life story in a transformation.
Okay, so just if you don't mind, help me join some dots. So EY, one of the big four consultancies, they quite often get called, don't they? And they have vested interest in all sorts of business processes and that side of things. So your role within them is people related.
Yes, people consulting.
Work tech is partly about physical space and partly about technology, and obviously in service of people trying to get work done. But can you just join the dots? How do you go from sort of EY to the people consulting side of it to be here today?
The line between employee, consumer and customer is now as blurred as it's ever been. You know, we are the same people that go home and live the one-click world. Oh my God, I don't have something. I can do one click and it might be delivered the same evening in my house. So I am the same person that then goes to work. Why shouldn't I experience the same thing in the workplace? Our expectations as a society are changing dramatically. And we are consumer and customers in our everyday life, and we are starting to become consumer and customers in our workday life. And, you know, my job as a consultant is really to try and stay on top of these trends and kind of ask the better question, ask the new questions around how do we make sure that we do all we can as organizations, as enterprises, to use technology, to use digital innovation, everything that is thrown at us, but actually to harness the power of the human and respond to these needs so that we can give the human, that is the core of an organization, the real power to have an experience at work that resonates with their everyday life.
So you just used the word experience, and I was about to almost use it as a catch-all to say, so if we're talking about people as consumers, as customers, as employees, the words that you used earlier, and there's this kind of, you know, we wear multiple hats in the world, but there's this convergence around digital expectations. And the word I was going to say is, because we live in an experience culture and because that has become so prevalent in our lives. So here you are with humans at the center of everything. It sounds like it's literally in your very essence. This is what you believe. This is where you come from. You've been doing pieces of research through EY with, is it Said Business School?
It is. It's Oxford University Said Business School.
Brilliant. And so that's what you're talking about today. Is it case study research? Is it research that's ongoing?
It is ongoing research, but there is a one point in time finding that I'm talking about today, which is constantly refining. I'm going to talk about two different pieces of research. The part one is the humans at the center. And we went to survey about 2,000 people across almost a third split of the three geographies, so Americas, EMEA, and Asia Pac. Splitting between leadership and everybody else in the workforce so that we can get a real breadth of representation, and across 7 different industries, 16 different sectors, public, private, you name it. And then on top of that, we've done a qualitative interview of 25 of the top leaders globally. So, you know, as far as a sample goes, it's quite comprehensive.
In a particular organization or in lots of organizations?
Lots of organizations. These are representatives of, as I was saying, is, you know, globally and 7 different industries and 16 different sectors. So should be quite, it's quite representative, I think, confidence, the sample set is quite interesting. And then the survey based for the baseline data and then predictive analytics to think about, you know, what is that drives success for a transformation. And that's what brings to the what we call the 6 key drivers of a transformation. So it's not the fluff of consulting, it's actually data-driven. What are the 6 key things that can really improve a transformation?
So these have emerged out of your data set, essentially, these 6 key things.
So yes, of course, it's 6 of them is to inspire, to care, to build, to empower, to lead, and to collaborate. And basically, they are all engraved in the concept of you need to balance the logical side, which is what everybody knows, the KPIs, the target, the dashboard, all of that, with the emotional side of a transformation. And we use emotional not in the soft way of the term, but actually something quite measurable and strong. So the understanding that you need to create a purpose for people to get behind, in the understanding that you need to understand who the leaders are across all layers of the organization. So leader, not just at the top of the organization, but at every layer of the organization, and the influencers within the organization, which is a term I quite like because it, again, it marries everyday life with the work life, and create a culture where, you know, people feel free to feedback and can see the result of their feedback, but also where organizations are able to manage levels of stress. Because a transformation will have a point of stress, and that is a fact. And it's about how do you manage stress? How do you prepare the leadership and the people to understand that the moment of stress is going to arrive and then how to use that as a springboard for the outcome.
Okay, so let me just quickly recap and check I understand this. So this piece of research has yielded through both quantitative and qualitative data, including some predictive analytics, which I want to come back to. I teach organizational change modules, and we know that we can turn to the likes of Kotter and Adkar and McKinsey 7S, and there are models for change. Is this a model that you're now using? Is it a model that you're advocating people use? Is this giving EY something new, which they will use with clients? What's the application of your findings?
I'm going to go way back. It's not a model. It really is hard data of these are the six things.
When taken singularly, can already create an incremental level of likelihood of success for a transformation. That's singularly, but the real power comes when we can combine all six areas. And, you know, the predictive analysis talks about a 2.6 times increase in the likelihood of a success for a transformation.
Now, if you think about the current statistic, a transformation succeeds about 10 to 30% of the time. I mean, it's abysmal how low the statistic is, right? If you think about the pound sign and dollar sign behind any transformation and you translate that in that percentage, and if you did that and extrapolated it and put it on any other investment, public or private, people would be out of the streets, absolutely screaming, what are we doing? And yet the organization has resigned, right? So it's not a model. It is really the six critical investment points, key drivers, that an organization need to think about at the very beginning of the transformation for the investment, because the return of investment at the end is, is amazing. It speaks for itself. How do we use it? Yeah, we are absolutely using it now with our clients to talk about the investment upfront. You teach organizational change management, so I'm talking to somebody that can understand the pain. It's not necessarily the first thing that the client wants to think about. For many years, it's changing, I have to say. For many years, clients, they have to spend a lot of money in the technology, in the processes, in the operating model. Why would they want to spend money on organizational change? And to these days, I have conversation where I almost have to justify my existence in the working world around what I do. But it's becoming more and more prominent to understand that is actually quite an important part of investment you need to do. For me, it's becoming easier to have the conversation because now I have the data to prove it. I can go to my clients and I can talk to them about what we did with Oxford and we are doing with Oxford Said Business School. I can really back it up with hardcore data that says, well, actually, look at this. This is globally. And the return on investment, because that's ultimately what it is. You invest in something for a return, could be quite substantial, and it makes my life easier really to have the conversation and back up what I've been saying for years, me and all my fellow colleagues in the field.
Okay, Chris, so what did you get from that conversation?
I thought it was really interesting when she was talking about, right at the start of the interview, she was talking about the sort of expectations of employees. And that's something that I think most conferences have been talking about for a long while, whether it's the hotelling of the workplace or the homing of the workplace. There's lots of different ways of skinning it. But I've always kind of felt that we've reached a point in time where a lot of the digital experiences that you have outside of work are better than the ones you have inside of work. And that wasn't always the case. So that sort of expectation's going up. And that leads to something I've thought for a long while, is that this kind of meeting expectations is something that marketers have had to do for a long while. You know, expectations of consumers and how that changes and monitor those changes and adapt to those changes. And it kind of talks to a long-held view I've had that actually marketing competences, not the surface-level ones, we all see the advertising stuff, but marketing competences are probably the most useful competences for workplace leaders. Now, one of the ones that sprung to mind in this one was when I worked at the Institute of Marketing, there was a course that I never really understood what it was or why it was on the listing, but it was behavioral economics. And What a fascinating topic that is, about decision-making that people make, why they make decisions, what drives those decisions, what the outcomes are from those decisions. And wow, wouldn't a lot of workplace folk like to understand that at the moment? Why are people making those choices and decisions? And the third thing that kind of sprung to mind was when she was talking about the factors that they uncovered and actually how they multiply each other. And it just reminded me of that conversation we had with Kirsty Groves way back in our first ever proper interview on this podcast, episode 2, where we were talking about multipliers versus additions in these sort of theoretical frameworks and how something as simple as that is really important from, you know, actually if one of these doesn't work, then the whole sum falls down, you know. So there's loads in there. It's a really interesting take on something that most organizations are battling with in some way, shape or form.
I'm really glad that you kind of made those observations, because you've seen totally different things to, I think, what I was getting from it. I mean, I was obviously there in the moment in the discussion, but I think the kind of teacher in me, and I teach change and transformation as part of kind of like business studies courses and stuff like that. I was really focused on the sort of the shape of the framework, the shape of the model. Valeria was adamant that it wasn't a model, so maybe more of a recipe, but essentially these sort of key ingredients for success. And you've sort of, I think, thought about the ripples, which is kind of cool, because I really loved that chat, so much so that, like Edwin Heathcote from the previous WorkTech episode, we've invited Valeria back to talk at more length about the research and how EY have been putting it into practice. She's going to join us later this year in season 3, which is nice.
Look at you just dishing out invites to season 3. Let you loose at an event and you're handing out tickets to this prestigious podcast. Anyway, let's get on to our next interview. Ian, tee us up. Who are we going to listen to?
So if our first segment with Valeria was kind of about theory and knowledge, the other two of this episode explore change projects essentially in practice. One's from the health sector, one's from the legal sector. So next, we're going to explore a pilot study from the UK National Health Service with Rebecca Grindley, Milton Keynes University Hospital, new hospital programme director. Now, Rebecca is a qualified architect who found her way into the NHS around 15 years ago. And she was at WorkTech sharing insights from a pretty groundbreaking project that her and her colleagues had been running about what they term location intelligence. The session was called How Smart Hospitals Are Using Location Data to Transform Healthcare. And it's essentially about using Internet of Things, or IoT is the abbreviation, technology, to tag both inanimate and animate objects. So think things like keys or medicines, and also animate things like people, so they can be found in real time, which when it comes to critical medical services, this can literally be life-changing. So, Chris, a nice way to sort of bring this to life, and Rebecca does exactly this in her session, is to frame it as a sort of real-world Marauder's Map from Harry Potter. So imagine being able to call up your iPad or laptop screen and see the person you're looking for moving about, or spot where something that you need next has gone. And so the point of this, in Rebecca's words, is to improve staff productivity and collaboration, optimize resource utilization, reduce energy consumption, and enhance patient safety and experience. So here we go.
My name is Rebecca Grindley. I'm the programme director for our new hospitals programme at Milton Keynes University Hospital, which we call MK View.
Why do you call it MK View?
It's the view of the future.
Oh, right. Has it always been that, or has that evolved over time?
That's all the branding comms work. So no, it was as part of a 48 hospital programme set up, you need to identify your own new hospital programme from the national new hospital programme. So we gave us a name.
And I overheard before we started recording that whilst you work for the NHS, you're actually a qualified architect.
That's right. I started in commercial in private practice, working on things like leisure centres and quarter redevelopments in France. And in 2009, when there was a bit of a recession, I just moved down into their London office and they closed their London office. And digital working wasn't quite as good. Remote working wasn't quite as good then. And so I decided to look somewhere else and I ended up in the NHS. It's been great working for the NHS, because actually what you realise is, whereas you choose to go to a shopping centre, you choose to go to a cinema, whatever, you know, health centre, leisure centre, you don't choose to go to hospital, mostly. You know, it's somewhere that making the environment right makes a real difference to people who use it, both staff and patients.
I was listening to something the other day. I can't remember what it was. It'll come back to me. But somebody pointed out that hospital and hospitality, very close words.
My parents had a hotel. And I think part of my frustration with the NHS as a whole is that sometimes we forget that actually the clients, the customers, the patients, whatever we want to call them, we have to create a service for them to use. They have an experience, they have an opinion, they have a voice. And I think we sometimes forget that. And perhaps that's because they're not paying at the door.
Yes. And that's what I was trying to get with this relationship between hospital and hospitality.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely really interesting.
So just for the benefit of listeners who weren't here with us, what were you talking about and why is it an important topic?
So we were talking about smart building utilisation, and this is about how the estate in the NHS is catching up with our digitisation of electronic patient records. So looking at how we use sensors and digital systems that I don't know the details of and present them in a platform that allows the building users to see, have transparency on their how their building is being used, whether that's temperature, whether it's asset location, whether it's utilisation, activity. We've put it all into a single platform to allow building users to make better decisions.
So that sounds like a lot of sensor-enabled stuff, which isn't unusual in progressive organisations now, but it sounds, the fact that it's in the NHS, that sounds a bit unusual. Does it stop at sensors of physical space, or are we talking about tracking and monitoring and understanding more than just the inanimate? Help me understand a bit more.
Yeah, so it's both. We've got two systems. So the two in the cancer centre, which is our initial pilot for this platform, we've got two systems. One is a ThingSee sensor, which does what a lot of things do on the market, and that identifies whether a desk is in use or a paper dispenser is empty, whether a room's in use. It's just an occupancy sensor. It's pretty basic. And then we've also got overlaid into that platform Cooper sensors. Now, the Cooper sensors are a real-time locating system. So onto that system, we've put in our assets. So we've got our assets tracked around the wards. We've got our staff voluntarily tracked around the walls. So the nurses will go on, pick up a sensor, they'll register themselves, and they will then be seen on the map, this marauder's map, as I described, of things and where they are on the ward. And then we've started looking at environmental data as well. So we started looking at things like temperature, looking at carbon dioxide, and then we start to look at how we might understand some more about patient data. So we've overlaid things like nurse call so that you can see that in a central platform as well.
So within a clinical environment, within the National Health Service, we have got building sensors, the likes of which any sort of progressive organisation might be considering for their real estate. You've also got environmental sensors for air quality, CO2 levels, whatever. If we can measure it, we can bring that in. But on top of that, you are tracking in real time moving assets, like people, including clinical staff, and who are volunteering, I'm choosing that word carefully because I think this was a key part of some of your discussion, volunteering to be part of this. What are the benefits from bringing the Marauder's map layer, for all Harry Potter fans out there, bringing the Marauder's map layer into the fixed map?
So the reason that people will volunteer for it, obviously you have to set it first, but once you get a pilot up and running, starting small, we have demonstrated the benefits by listening to the staff. So all of a sudden they could see assets around the building, and then they said, actually, we'd really love to understand where the keys are. So these are the medical cabinet keys for controlled drugs. And for a controlled drugs round, you need two nurses, two qualified nurses, and you'll need the keys. So if somebody needs to, say, get a top-up for an infusion pump, they need to find another nurse and they need to find the keys. And they were spending quite a lot of time in these single-room environments, walking up down the corridors, figuring out who was where to bring those various different aspects together.
Literally looking for people.
Literally looking for people and stuff. Mm-hmm. So they found that was something that helped them straight away. And it's those kind of instant gratification, isn't it? That kind of quick return, those easy wins, that all of a sudden people go, actually, this is something that could work for us. There was, in that little room to the right-hand side, that was a doctor's office, and all the wows would sit in there all day because the doctors would want to carry on doing their work on the wow, that's a worked up on wheels, sorry, for those of you that aren't in the NHS. And they'd hide it in their room because they could carry on. And actually, they've got desks that they can use. So giving people the transparency of what's going on in their building has actually allowed them to better use the assets within the building. We've also put in some environmental sensors. This is probably something we want to expand. But what we've got in the top room there is a medications room. So what we know is that the patients are cosy and warm. They like a bit of a hotter temperature than us at that 24 degrees C. But we've got a cooler medications room, and that needs to be kept at a lower level for the drugs. And we know that the temperature in the fridge. And what the platform has now done is it's allowed us to look at how we alert pharmacy. So taking time back from the nurses so they can spend more time with their patients. So the ethics of it, we don't keep any of the historic data. So this is all about what matters to the building users in that time. As an organisation, you need to be quite careful to use that data in the right way. So we're not looking at when people turn up or looking at when people take breaks or how long they were in the staff room. That's not what we're doing with it. And you could easily go very quickly wrong. This is data for the people in the building. And it does allow us as a capital projects team to then start to look at how we can design better. So what we found was actually there's two nurses stations in the cancer centre, and we found a clustering of both assets around those nurses stations and actually activity around the patient rooms in those areas. So they were using the nurses stations as hubs where they could see their colleagues, and they were kind of using those as bases to deliver care from. Actually, we saw a change in behaviour with assets, so that rather than those being completely co-located with the nurses' stations, there's a better distribution of the assets. So the Welsh Allen machines that worked up on wheels, the wows, that sort of thing would move around the building better because we could see them. So they were able to go and get a wow from a junior doctor's office and say, actually, I'm going to take that and use that clinically because I need it. So you saw the kind of blue dots as historic asset locations from being working out around the nurses' stations and the kind of core areas where people could see each other and see the things, to being distributed throughout the building better.
So when you say that you've got a clinical member of staff logging themselves into the system or whatever the language is,
yep,
are they basically signing in and taking a tag and putting it in their pocket?
The first time they take a tag and they will log on. Every other time, the system, we've got single user authentication. We've integrated the platform into the empathic building platform into our Teams platform. So actually, that is software that they're already using. That we've got a bring your own phone, bring your own device policy at work. So people will already have access to Teams on their handheld devices.
Microsoft Teams.
So the app has then been integrated into that. So in a system that they're already using to communicate across the organisation, we've got that data in there. So it's easily accessible for people who are already using it.
What I think is really interesting about this, and you tell me whether this is a key takeaway or not, is the fact that it solves genuine pains for the staff. It is familiar in the sense that where you can access the information in real time in a way that helps me as a member of the team is already familiar to me. So if you were thinking about this in sort of value proposition or in user experience design terms, you are lowering barriers to entry and you are solving pains of your staff.
If you have high thresholds to entry, it doesn't happen and without a great deal of effort, a great deal of training, a great deal of kind of push from the organisation to implement it. So we don't have that weight behind us because it's not a clinical system and it's an estate system. So the ease of adoption was really important, and actually we don't need to train anybody in the system. It is so intuitive. You can log yourself on, sign up, and you own that data. You can delete your profile whenever you want. And I think that really helps people feel that they have ownership of their data.
You keep mentioning the word pilot, so it's in its early stages. Is this unique within the NHS, or is it a handful of progressive projects like this?
I haven't seen anything like this in the NHS. It was interesting to me because when we started, I thought we'd start going talking to people about it, and that people say, yeah, we've already got that. But they don't. Other hospitals are now starting to look at it. They understand that there are benefits associated with it. I think one of the big areas of benefit will be around soft FM services. So, you know, how we clean our wards. If you have an understanding of how often you use your bathrooms, or how often your paper dispensers are emptied, or how often you need to empty your bins, then you can only do it when you need to do it. And then you can tailor your workforce to make sure that you're doing it as efficiently as possible and making sure that the ward has what it needs, but you're not putting too much effort into it by emptying half full bins all the time, for instance, or cleaning bathrooms that haven't been used.
Why do you think it is the only one that you're aware of and so progressive?
So as part of the new hospital programme, we had a team that was set up in, when I say a team, there was two of us initially, myself and our digital lead was Claire Orchard, has done a lot of this actually at the coalface. We developed our kind of roadmap, of what we would need to be able to, and I think getting those fundamentals right in that roadmap has really helped as well. So what data do we need to collect? Where are we going to store it, and how is it going to talk to each other? I think the Empathic Buildings platform actually does a lot of those things for us. It's a very simple platform, and a lot of people say, well, it's not a digital twin because it's not real information. What I think it is a viewport to a digital twin, because digital twins can be really inaccessible. This is a really, really simple model, but within it, we can access in a very kind of easy, almost childlike way, the information that we need.
So Empathic Buildings is a brand, is a company.
Halcyon are a Norwegian tech company, and Empathic Buildings is one of their products, I suppose.
Fascinating.
In the presentation, you'll see the platform demoed, and you'll see how things move around in a building. It's not a particularly active time in the building. When I recorded it, you just pick 2 minutes, don't you, and you kind of see what happens. But you can start to see some of the kind of information that is made available to people in real time. And it will take you through the integration and trend as well. So you'll be able to see what that all looks like. So, and the really nice thing about the whole thing is that when we share it with other staff, and I think this is a real benefit to starting small and showing people what the platform can do, is that every other department that's seen it, every other hospital that's seen it, have said, this is interesting, we would like to do this. So I think there's huge benefit in a NHS that is really struggling with resource on a day-to-day basis, whether that's staff resource, financial resource, you know, logistics. It really, it's a way of making it more efficient. And I think efficiency is key, isn't it, in the NHS? So if we can do that and allow nurses to spend more time with patients, it's going to be better for everyone, right? And I was saying, you know, it's obviously having the nurses and the doctors give us feedback and say, we'd like to see this, we'd like to do this. You know, some medications fridges is one thing that we're going to look at doing. And rather than a nurse going and putting the temperature down, if that is automated on the system, and that triggering an alarm when, you know, medications fridges are getting too hot, yeah, you know, then we can save thousands in terms of medications stored, you know, if we were able to pick that up early enough. So the hope is that we can just make it a little bit better for everyone and take some of that pressure off the NHS. But, you know, it's step by step.
All right, Chris, so I found this one completely inspiring. What do you reckon?
I think between this interview and our one with Susan Halford, where we talked about the Room of Requirement, another Harry Potter trope, I'm surprised we haven't had a knock on the door from the Warner Brothers legal team. Maybe J.K. Rowling was actually a secret workplace consultant, or maybe all workplace consultants have been totally inspired by the Hogwarts experience. Who knows? But in all seriousness, what I enjoyed about this, well, what I got thinking about was the value exchange. Again, I'm sort of a bit of a theme here. It's another marketing idea, right? Which is, from a consumer point of view, what am I sacrificing in order to extract value? And does that value exceed what I'm sacrificing? That's ultimately what it is. Now, the easy example of that is something like price. I had to pay something. I sacrificed a tenner, but did that what I get provide me value that I I deem to be in excess of that tenor. And why I thought about that in this example was I suspect that there is this sort of terror that would have gone through people about being tracked, about people being able to find them. And then what you got from Rebecca was people started saying, well, actually, no, that's actually quite handy, now you mention it. And you start to see the improvements. So quite often when you present something in almost like two-dimensionally and say, this is what's going to happen, people's minds run away with them and they can't see the value yet. So sometimes you just need to do it, and then start that conversation. I do think a key part of that, though, will be that sense of agency. I remember when there was a kind of a, it was with teams, and I can't remember, it must have been pre-pandemic, where you were sort of encouraged to put your location when you logged on in the morning. You're almost told, like, put what you're doing or your location up in the top right-hand corner. What a faff that is. Now, this takes that out of it, but you do kind of suspect that some people will go, no, I'm trying to hide. You know, what you don't want to see is, like in Harry Potter, two people in the same room clearly having a meeting, and then your mind starts going, I wonder what they're talking about. Oh, you know, such and such happened yesterday. I bet that's about this. Or HR are in the room with another individual. So you can see where it, you know, where people's heads go. But as long as you've got some agency around that, it's a really exciting development in this whole Internet of Things application.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, in our industry, Internet of Things has been sort of the digital technology that people have been jumping at for a good few years, you know, around building sensors and air quality sensors and all the different types of sensors. But actually tracking things which are moving around, that's really, really interesting. And you're right, the whole voluntary nature of it, because I perceive benefit, that is, talking back to Valeria's first session, that is the human emotional element, which you have to crack. Otherwise, stuff like this doesn't work. And I love the fact that this almost spins up interest. It spun up interest within the case study hospital, and it's spinning up interest beyond, because nobody's seen something like this be so powerful before. It's brilliant. It also gets me thinking about a really, really old podcast and a really, really old episode on this podcast called 99% Invisible, which is hosted by this legendary figure in podcasting called Roman Mars. And this episode was called The Blue Yarn. And it's literally about 15 minutes long. It's about a cancer care center in America. And they were struggling to make this center effective, make it do what it needed to do for the patients in any way at all. It was basically failing. And they turned their attention to the Toyota lean production way of thinking all the way out in Japan to essentially flip the hospital and put patient care at the epicenter of everything they did. And what that did, and it's really worth listening to, so I'll stick a link in the show notes, it highlighted the amount of waste within healthcare. And waste in healthcare is people basically sat or lying there waiting. And how, if you recognize that and visualize it and shift the whole, as you say, value exchange model, then healthcare transforms. So there's a real parallel there. And I just think this example from Rebecca is fantastic.
Your points there about application and about it making a difference, that's something that was echoed by one of the attendees at the show. So whilst you were in rooms dishing out invites to season 3, I was actually out amongst the attendees and I caught up with Doug Lowry. Now, Doug is the global director for WX, which is the workplace consultant studio that is part of Sodexo, the big facility services company. And he was really taken by Rebecca's presentation. And he talked a little bit about how nice it was to see something in practice making a difference.
What piqued my interest is it was the first articulation of how to turn insights into action. And it was done from an operational perspective. Okay? So it wasn't just talking about sensors, it wasn't talking about data, it wasn't talking about tech. It was talking about what you do with that and how do you change the efficiencies of the operationals of the hospital and the ease of getting things done. And obviously it's in some way near and dear to all of our hearts in the NHS, where we know it's under pressure, we know it's cost pressure, we know it's time pressure, and we also know that they need a lot more efficiency. They're not going to get much more funding anytime soon, clearly, and therefore they need to work smarter.
And your sort of suggestion there that there's lots of tech about, there's lots of sensors about, and we've heard lots of presentations about them. you're sort of saying there what you liked about Rebecca's talk was that she got into the practical, the application of it.
She did.
Do you think there's a bit too much focus on what stuff can do as opposed to why you should do this?
Absolutely. Yeah. We've got lots of clients who come to us and say, we've just spent £1 million on our smart building. It's fantastic. Show me the ROI. And we turn around and say, well, we're looking at our service agreement and we clean the toilets, we man the reception, and we keep the coffee hot. Why are you asking us about the ROI of a smart building? The reality is they've been sold lots of shiny objects. They invested in it. They don't know how to operate. They don't know how to get that return. Okay, you shouldn't do it unless you've got a goal and objective around how do you operate better, more efficiently, at a better cost. And that's what we're now working into. So yesterday was a great example, because what Rebecca did was show everyone in that room how to take that data, put it into practical application, and solve pain points in that hospital, whether through efficiency or finding or keeping track of products or equipment, or even about shortening journey times or minimizing wasted time, which was fascinating. Now, my question, which wasn't, I entered into the Slido comments, the question to say, how big is the team that you're working with to do this? Because that's what I'm interested in. I want to know what skill sets do we need to be able to do that. And so I caught up with Arthur and I asked her that, and she was very much saying, it's just me. And I had a data person who was very good at data analytics, and I'm blessed with a really good IT team who are happy to help. It's not their day job at all. Their day job is keeping the hospital running. But they were really curious about what we were trying to do, and they supported us really well.
Right.
Because I'm looking at saying, well, these are the kind of future roles that FM providers are going to have to supplement to our clients, because our clients are not going to do it internally. So we need to start looking at the market for the right job skill sets around data. And you can say, okay, we need a data scientist, we need a data analyst, we need a data architect. Do we? And I think one of the comments that came out yesterday as well was, well, how about a data socialist? Or someone actually looks at the social behavior patterns that have key indicators from data, because that's what it's all about. It's understanding human behavior. I think we fall into this risk in the prop tech industry of focusing so much on the technology, what the sensors can do, all the wonderful things it can say. But unless you put it into an application and actually apply it in a human environment that benefits human beings, it's pointless.
So, Ian, one more to go. Who is our final work tech interview with?
Okay, so finally, an opportunity to explore a long-term view of workplace change in a UK-based legal firm, Burgess Salmon LLP. So we've got Anna Taylor, change manager, and Eddie Twemlow, head of IT and operations, and they're talking about their session, which was called The Power of Workplace, Connecting for Success. And this session examined the evolution of their own agile workplace, offering lots of different invaluable lessons about the relationship between design, emotion, there's that emotion word again, and business success. It focuses primarily on their Bristol office, but there's also wider implications across the estate. And what I really like about this case study, Chris, is it's kind of long-term, or if we're going to use a research term, longitudinal perspective, because it starts well before the pandemic. It starts pre-pandemic around workplace expectations, moves into the pandemic, and then out with us all on the other side. And some really, really practical, very relatable findings and insights from this study. So just one last thing, it's worth just quickly noting that in the live clip of this one, there's another voice, a chap called Richard Clark, who was also there with Anna and Eddie on stage, but he wasn't with us in the interview. So that's the voice that you've not heard before, if that makes sense.
Well, let's go and have a listen.
I'm Anna Taylor. I'm a change manager in Burgess Salmon, which is a law firm. So my job is all about dealing with the impact of change on our people. It's a UK-based law firm based out of Bristol.
We operate globally with a through a network of preferred firms. I'm Eddie Twemlow. I'm the head of technology and operations in Burgess Salmon. I'm, like Anna, also based out of Bristol.
So you were presenting a case study today. The case study was called The Power of Workplace, Connecting for Success.
So yeah, it was essentially a storytelling session. So we were telling our story about what's happened in our workplace over a sort of 13-year period, how that's evolved and changed and the mindset change around that. And we based it around a kind of triad of things. So the success of our business, the culture of the firm, and the sort of design and the experience of the workplace. And so we sort of pinned the discussion around those three things, essentially. Mm.
So why did you identify those three things over a 13-year period as the framework to think of? Why is that important?
I think we have sort of realised over that time that those three things are all interdependent. So it's that realisation, really, that you can't have one without the other. You can't have a successful business unless you have a great culture, and you can't have a great culture unless you've got a really fantastic workplace.
So fundamentally, we're really interested in business success. And at Burgess Salmon, we really believe and we know that our culture underpins that success. It's central to it. And given some of the shifts that we've seen in the last decade or so, how we go about designing our environment, our office environment, and the technology that supports that has been directly connected to our culture. And that has changed. How we design our office space, our technology in the last decade has moved on, and we wanted to tell that story. So if we go back to when our building was designed around 2007-08, that was very much designed around the culture of the time, cellular offices for lawyers, all those things, identity and space and ownership, really important, close the door and get your head down and be able to focus and concentrate on that work. We were in quite a tired old building at the time, so we wanted to bring that kind of architectural feel to a much more brighter and modern space. And that's what we did. So we built a really lovely glass building in the centre of Bristol, full of cellular offices. And everybody loved it at the time.
Okay, that sounds like it's a dot, dot, dot. So this is a longitudinal case study. So Anna, what happened next?
Over time, between 2010 and kind of 2020, I suppose, one of the realisations was that we were going to run out of space. So that was like a big driver in terms of what we had to do next. But then also the world is changing, isn't it? So, you know, as lots of other professional services firms are going open plan and that's kind of the norm, we started obviously to investigate other working formats. And I think we did probably reach the realisation that that was the right way to go. And then the pandemic hit. So, you know, that was a bit of a kind of take restock kind of moment.
So here we were, a business where the idea of kind of not having your own office or a fixed desk made people a bit nervous, let alone other kind of more flexible working arrangements like working from home. And pretty much overnight, we transitioned to be an entirely home-based workforce. Richard, it was difficult for everyone, obviously, personally working in this time, but how did things work from a business perspective?
Well, it was absolute madness, wasn't it? And, I mean, it was incredible how COVID was that catalyst for change, and how projects which we'd been working on for, you know, a year, 2 years, suddenly within a week were then embraced and became standard. You know, working on Teams, for example, was something we tried to adopt many, many times, and lots of resistance to that. But also we were dealing with a lot of clients in crisis. Real crisis, some real tensions coming through to us. And so, you know, we had to make sure that whatever crisis we were dealing with, we were coping with theirs and managing theirs and really servicing our clients and putting them first.
When we focus on space and what you were seeking to achieve, net benefit because of what you learned during the pandemic, or net challenge, how would you talk about what the pandemic did for this case study?
We talked actually about the burning platform of the pandemic, and from a change management perspective, it kind of helped us. I don't want to go through that again, but you know, it accelerated a shift in our thinking when it came to how we would use the workplace. And you know, lots of people who were previously would never have worked from home, for example, are completely converted overnight to working from home. So then they start to come back to the office and they're much more open to the idea of different kind of working formats. So yeah, it's moved us a long way, I think.
So, Eddie, to your expertise, technology wasn't explicitly in that three-part framework because you were talking about the business, the people and culture. So where does technology live in that framework? How would you position it?
So I suppose around 2015, 16, we used to talk about lawyers and business professionals working in a mobile way. So we gave them the tools to be able to operate wherever they needed to be operating, whether that be in a client site, whether it be environments like the one we're in today, or whether it be in the office. So you pick up your laptop, everyone has one, you pick up your mobile phone and you go and you do the work. And space became less significant as a place where you had to carry out your work. Clearly, as the pandemic ran its course and we had people permanently based at home, then connectivity of technology between colleagues and clients became even more essential. It wasn't just about working in a mobile way, it was about being able to connect properly and allowing those rich conversations to take place that people would normally have in person.
So, Anna, if we, you know, this was a case study based upon your headquarters, and it sounds like it was a significant piece of work in all sorts of different ways. So what internal insights have you found and how would you sort of explain them?
One of the biggest learnings around people is that you've got to take them on the journey with you. So, you know, whatever you can do to kind of talk to your people, understand them, listen to their fears. You know, we had a lot of consultation in the work that we've done. And some of that is just a case of kind of letting people air their thoughts around things. And, you know, what are they afraid of? Even if you can't necessarily do anything about it, there's a process that you need to go through. And I think for us, that's probably the biggest learning from a change perspective.
So creating an opportunity for people to feel that they've been listened to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's really interesting because a lot of firms can shy away from that because they feel like they're then setting themselves up to be hostages to fortune, that people will turn up with shopping lists and they'll be aggrieved when you don't deliver. What I hear with your case is actually the act of listening is part of the change process.
Yes, it is definitely. And I think you've got to be careful. You can't, you know, it's not a sweet shop. You know, you can't say, give us a list of all the things you want. So you've got to be honest in the way you're questioning people, I think, and sort of have integrity around that. But, you know, like you say, giving people a chance to just air their feelings on things is really valuable.
Part of the change. And Eddie, then, if we stretch beyond the organisation and if somebody is listening to this thinking, I'm going through a very similar thing, legal firm or otherwise, what would you say were the killer insights that you must not lose sight of?
Sure. So first of all, it's not a one moment in time thing. We'll continue to evolve and our culture will continue to evolve and we'll therefore have to keep an eye on our architecture. So if we start building walls and permanent structures, it's going to be very hard to change that. So designing flexibility, furniture, fewer walls. If you're an organisation a bit like Burgess Salmon, you're going to be really interested in things like confidentiality and connectivity. So acoustics may sound like a very specific thing, but it's quite an expensive thing to get wrong. So I'd really make sure people understood that. And clearly, connectivity using technology, that seems to be the thing that people are most interested in. So I don't think you can really underinvest in that.
So one last time, Chris, what did you make from that?
Well, I guess this is really what the sector needs to start seeing coming through, which is this kind of comparison pre and post, but also measuring and understanding stuff as we went through the pandemic. There's been a lot of statements made and headlines made and all the rest of it, but actually it's going to be through stories like this where we actually do learn stuff from people telling their story, what they learn, and sharing that. That's so important as well. There's so few people in this world that we occupy that are willing to talk about case studies where they didn't get things right. And I thought these guys were really open about it. They said, you know, we went in one direction. Do you know what? It just didn't work. And that's really refreshing. So I think that's great. I think we're also, in a way, fortunate that they were doing this at a time where the pandemic landed. You know, they were already looking at this stuff. They were tracking it. They were measuring stuff. They were doing the right things. And that meant that when the pandemic did land, and because they carried on doing that and looked at it post, is that we have got that data, that insight through. So we're fortunate, but there must be more people that have done that. They can't have been the only organization looking at workplace change when the pandemic happened. And we want to hear more of that. And I think the more people that share that story, the better we're going to be as a sector, the less sort of sensational headlines we're going to get. We can just sort of get to the nitty gritty and understand and learn.
Yeah. So an honesty-based approach to essentially evidence rather than opinion, I think is what you're saying there.
I think that's what I'm saying too. Well, do you know what? We also caught up with another delegate who was there at the show to see what they thought of this. So this is Richard Bertram. Now, we know Richard. We know the guys at TSK, big friends of the show. Hi, guys. We asked him what he thought about the presentation from the team at Burgess Salmon.
I thought it's like most of the talks here, it was very inspirational. And how they're going on a journey, and it's a continuing journey, and how there's been bumps in the road caused by the pandemic. But they had this really good thing where they, it's driven by the three pillars they were talking about, which is the success of the firm, then the culture of the organisation, and linking all that to their workplace design and user experience, customer experience. They've pulled lots of information in from various places. Lots of change for the organisation coming out of big centre offices into the open plan. Lots of nervousness and how they were going to manage that. And it's all about taking people on the journey. And I think that's one of the really good things about WorkTech. It's all about technology. You see this fantastic development of tech. But it all comes back to people and how you get people to understand the changes and go on that journey. And they put it across really well about how culture is so important to them, and they see that as the big differentiator, and how they're going to use their new workplace, which will have a much more domestic feel to it. They show what the new atrium will look like and how that will be used to entice people into the workplace and get them to actually be part of that great culture they've got.
And that is WorkTech 23 London done. If you've enjoyed the content from this episode and the previous episode, do check out worktechevents.com. They literally have events all over the world. There will be one near you somewhere. But for those of you in the UK, there are some coming up soon. So on the 18th of June, they're going to be in Manchester. And then this one that we've been talking about, that returns to London on the 19th of November. So do go and check it out. Next week, we have the first in another two-part event special where we'll be returning to workplace trends. We were there with the team in October for their flagship conference. So join us next week for another fast-paced trip through workplace insights. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on your chosen platform so you get alerts about new episodes as they're published. Follow us on LinkedIn, just search for the Workplace Geeks, and sign up for the Workplace Geeks newsletter at workplacegeeks.org. for the latest episodes, blogs, event discounts, and other brilliant Workplace Geeks stuff. Speak to you next time. If you're looking for more Workplace Geeks content to keep you ticking over until the next episode, why not check out the Mighty Science of Service podcast, hosted by me and Ian, which sees us exploring the ways that their clients are using cutting-edge technology to transform their approaches to the climate, security, workplace experience, and health and hygiene. Search for the Science of Service podcast and visit mighty.com/podcasts. That's MITIE.com/podcasts.